Well, I knew the importance of the occasion. I remember Mr. Ricky saying to me that I couldn't fight back.
I think the conscience of America is beginning to awaken. The only thing that we're demanding is that we be allowed to move ahead just like any other American.
In 1997, Jackie's number was retired. And in 2004, Gene Hermansky's words from 1950 came to fruition. We'll all wear number 42.
Well, excited to have our guest Dave Sims to help us celebrate Jackie Robinson Day. Major League Baseball on April 15th to commemorate the year and day that Jackie Robinson broke into Major League Baseball, the Brooklyn Dodgers, on April 15th, 1947, has a day where we reflect on his legacy, we think about where it's going forward, and of course, you know, all the games, players will be wearing 42 in his image. And no better guest to talk about my profession in the media world than Dave Sims, who is a commentator, play-by-play with the Seattle Mariners, his 16th season. And as a black man in this industry, understanding whether the unique challenges or the pioneering steps that you've taken along the way to be here and in your uniqueness, I thought it'd be fantastic to consider Jackie Robinson through that lens. And, you know, Jackie Robinson, we know on the field did tremendous things, a Hall of Famer, but he also pioneered and celebrated many firsts off the field, whether in banking, whether in media as a columnist, whether as an executive at Chock Full of Nuts. And so, Dave, I wanted to start about, well, first, Philly native, right? So we we have that history. but so I think as we look at Jackie Robinson and the evolution of his legacy, I'd love to know more about your journey and how the pioneering steps you took to get to this point with the Seattle Mariners.
Well, before I even got it, first of all, you and I are part of Mr. Robinson's legacy. I mean, the fact that you had a great career as a baseball player and I'm doing what I'm doing. But my story with Mr. Robinson starts back when I was, I don't know, about probably 8 or 9. I started, you know, rummaging through some stuff that my old man had. And I kept coming up with these World Series programs, 47, 49, 52, 53. Turns out my dad, I guess before I was born, you know, he and his boys would drive up from Philly to Brooklyn to watch the Dodgers because, you know, basically the Brooklyn Dodgers were Black America's team for good reason. I mean, you know, Jackie Robinson, Newt Campy, Sandy Amoros, later Junior Gilliam, I mean, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then later on, flash forward, we'd be, you know, playing pickup games. My father would come out and pitch and we'd take BP and everybody would, you know, be getting some knocks and then he'd throw like 3 in a row at my head. I'm like, yo, hey, man. What do you think Jackie Robinson went through? Stand in there, dig in, and hit the next pitch right through the middle or, you know, whatever you got to do. And I was like, man, that started to seep in. So as I got older and reading about what Mr. Robinson and Mr. Doby went through, I got to know Mr. Doby. I never met Mr. Robinson. I call him that. It's hard for me to call him Jackie Robinson. I have to call him Mr. Robinson. I mean, my respect for the guy is just off the chart. And when you read about what he did, you know, born in Georgia, moved to Pasadena, you know, four sport athlete at UCLA and what he went through. This game, Doug, you know this better than I do, but baseball is a super difficult game and you're going to fail 70% of the time and be a star. And this man had to listen to, I mean, imagine somebody coming to your office and heckling you, calling you everything under the sun, but a child of God. And then to excel at the highest levels and, you know, rookie of the year MVP, it's just mind-boggling. And I wear the number 42 cap, which we got in Seattle. They gave out in Seattle one time on African-American Heritage Day. And I wear the cap out. I wear it when I'm dressed up, suit and tie. I wear it when I'm casual, if we're wearing sweaters on the air, because that's how much Jackie Robinson means. You know, one of the most consequential Americans in our history. And you know, in terms of the slings and arrows, I've been very lucky in that regard. Most of it's been subtle. But I can tell you this, and I probably did this when I think when we met, I was doing a Phillies Sunday show back in 99, 2000. I think you were at the Phillies at the time. And I consider myself a people person, but I got to tell you, there's such a dearth of Black Americans in the sport that I make it pretty much a policy to go say hello to any African-Americans. Hey, man, just like to say hello. like to see somebody that looks like me in our game, because we're down to 6% and less, and even fewer in the media.
Well, Dave, I mean, you know, you have a Philadelphia history, as we talked about, and one of the big moments in Jackie Robinson's history was going to Philadelphia. And that first road trip after he played these homestands, you know, being with Ben Chapman, the manager of the Phillies, and it was, you know, documented in the movie 42, where Philadelphia did not have a black player for 10 years after Jackie Robinson. So I'm curious about if that story, as you kind of revisited it later through, as it's become more public about, especially in the movie, I mean, what were your thoughts about, you know, your city and the adjustments the city made going forward?
Well, first of all, I was glad my grandparents got out of the South when they did, and they're part of the Great Migration early 20th century. But to your point, in 93, when the Phillies made the World Series and they played the Toronto Blue Jays, there was a heck of a piece in the Inquirer, Philadelphia Inquirer. A guy had gone to a barbershop in my neighborhood in the northwest part of town. And he had, you know, the usual 5, 10, 15 patrons in there. And basically, the guy went in there, "Hey, man, you guys rooting for the Phillies?" And all those, most of those cats, and they were my father's age, said, "Heck no. We were around. We remember as kids what the Phillies did." Ben Chapman, that picture where he and Jackie are holding the bat. And I know each one of them wanted to take that bat and beat each other in the head with it. But these cats in the barbershop said, "Hey, man, we have tremendous animus and anger at the Phillies organization for what happened back in 47 and how Jackie was treated." And I played for a guy in high school who was one of the bench jockeys. And he never told me that. He treated me like gold, but I later found that out. You know, it was like 40-some years later. But it was abusive, man. And Philly's a tough enough town as it is, you know, hardcore sports town, as you know. You went to school at Penn. And I can only imagine what the abuse was like. But anyway, the point being, those cats in the barbershop, that resentment, they were holding on to it. And even if they wanted to get rid of it, they couldn't, because they'd seen and heard and were told about what happened. And I looked it up one day, and I'll never forget Richie Ashburn, when I was at NBC Philly in 84, and he comes in to analyze the World Series that year. I said, "Whitey," I said, "I read a lot about what you guys did to Jackie Robinson." He said, "No, it was true." He says, "Chapman told us, spike him, spit at him, cuss at him, the whole thing." And Whitey said, "After a while, I went to him and said, 'Hey, Skip, you need to call this off. He's shoving it up our ass.'" I looked up the numbers. He had 318 career at Connie Mack Stadium with a big OPS. So the worst thing they did was get Mr. Robinson going. He put up good numbers. You can look it up. He put up good numbers at Chide Park / Connie Mack Stadium.
And
so,
yeah,
that's a heck. I mean, that's wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Well, and to your point, Dave, I mean, my personal story is that, and I've told this a few times about how my family migrated to North Philly and, you know, from North Carolina. A lot of my great aunts and uncles were there for a long time. And my mom would work in the summers in Philadelphia. And there was limited jobs, but she would work, save money, pay her way through Hampton Institute then, and then her sister. So she, that was, as the oldest, that was, you know, her job, right? That's what she was doing. Now, my family, they love baseball. But after Robinson, and they were in Philly, 47, they were done. And so what was so powerful for me is, you mentioned 93 World Series. Well, I got traded to Philly in 97. And in 98, you know, debuted as a starting center fielder. And that is when my aunt Tank, my great aunt Tank, said, okay, I can kind of revisit this. I mean, they followed from afar, but they just could not bring themselves to support the organization. That's how much pain and lack of restorative justice existed then, because it took so long to really recognize it. Now, I know the city did issue an apology, but that means something, because people were still in pain over that, because they could relate so directly to Jackie Robinson, who was handling this so nobly, by the way, considering what he was going through.
And there's a reason why he died at 53 years old. I mean, because he wore so much during his time from, what, 47 to 56, yeah, and particularly in his first, like, 3-4 years. I mean, I just can't imagine. And again, you look at his numbers, and, you know, during the time before Branch Rickey told him, "Hey, be yourself." I mean, the guy was like the ultimate alpha male. And for him to put up with that, I mean, that strength of character to do that is just, it's immeasurable.
Well, in your experience, you know, you've called sports, you know, play by play in so many different perspectives. I mean, you know, I mean, you go back to New York Daily News, I mean, Temple University, ESPN, NFL, and particularly 88 Olympics. So what have all these different journeys told you about, you know, sort of the pioneering road that you've taken and what it's taken to be able to endure or stay positive, you know, whether it's mentorship or just the professionalism that's required?
Well, I tell you what, I was really blessed. I mean, both my parents, for a very long time, they, you know, my brother and I, and born and raised in a Catholic education and the whole thing. And I guess my wife to this day says I'm always a glass half filled guy. I mean, I'm very positive. I consider myself a people person. And you have to be a people person to last almost, I'm coming up on 50 years next summer, count my internship, I'll be 50 years in the business, which is really amazing. And but I love what I do. I love sports. I was not made to be a biochemist, I can tell you that right now, with all due respect to those guys, and nor a brain surgeon. So I was, you know, in Philly, raised in Philly, playing balls at a very young age. And I was a pretty good baseball player, had some success in high school. And I remember a couple of guys say, hey, you're good, but I don't know if you're good enough to make it for pros, but you may want to think about a career covering it. And that's where it started. And I've been able to go through a myriad of steps. You mentioned the Olympics. That was an incredible thrill. That was the Ben Johnson Flojo Olympics in Seoul, South Korea. Did about 18 years in the NFL. I look back on it every now and then, and I know a lot of my friends probably wouldn't have done it because I've been alone, you know, like so many Black journalists, and as you're finding out now, Doug, we're all our own lone ranger. You know, it's like when you go, I think I'm the only lead TV announcer in Major League Baseball who's Black, and only maybe the fifth ever. Fifth ever. I mean, that's nuts. So I love what I do. I think that's a prevailing answer. I love what I do. And I've enjoyed the ride, I don't want to put it past tense yet. And, you know, I challenge myself too. You know, it's like, hey, would I like to, you know, and some of my friends who, I got a lot of friends who are white too, but I mean, a lot of my friends who are Black were spread out all over the country. So, you know, thankfully for FaceTime, I can catch up with you and some of the other guys. And because certainly on a daily basis, I'm in Chicago right now. And I love these guys, you know, I see the other broadcasters, but man, there's nobody else like me doing this gig. And I really have to, some days I have to like, you know, just do your job. You worry about that later. Just do your job and do the best you can be.
You know, so you think about Jackie Robinson, one thing that comes to mind is mentorship. And when you're a pioneer and you're kind of alone, you know, you're trying to chart your own waters, your references are outside the game because it's just you. You don't, you know, there's nobody came before you really in a direct sense. What's it been for you in your field, you know, doing that job, but also who have you looked to just get insight, wisdom, not only navigating the profession, but sometimes the subtleties of just dealing with race or being in around identity?
Well, Bill White was a guy I always looked up to as a player. And then he became, after he retired from the Phillies, he went into media, worked at ABC in Philly, and then, of course, as you know, worked his way up, you know, with the Yankees and everything was huge. And then I, you know, I really got a chance to know him a little bit when he was a National League president. And I told him, "Hey, Bill, I'm trying to get a baseball. Can you help me out?" Next thing you know, he was retired or forced out or whatever. But I've made a lot of friends in the business. I can think of guys I took to. I mean, Marty Brenneman, I met him when we were doing the Final Four broadcast in Minnesota. We had a 3-year run where we were Minnesota, Atlanta, and Indianapolis. Became good friends with him. Brad Sham was the voice of the Cowboys. Bob Wolf, a Hall of Fame announcer with the Washington Senators, did the Knicks. There's been a lot of guys, those kind of guys have been very helpful to me. And I was always, when I was a newspaper reporter, I used to go up to these guys, "Hey, man, I want to get in the business. I want to do what you do. What do you, you know, you got any tips, advice, or any things like that?" Dick Enberg was great, Vince Scully. Marv Albert was huge for me in New York. And in fact, Marv was the guy, my first huge break in electronic media was in 1986, WNBC Sports Night. They made a change, and I said, "That job's made for me to do a sports talk show." Opposite Art Rush Jr., who was a Black guy in New York who dominated the sports waves before FAN came along. So I went head to head with Art for 2.5 years before NBC shut down. But the key for me was my agent had called NBC, WNBC, and like, oh, okay, just sort of a blow off. And I called Marv, who I knew from when I was covering the Knicks. I said, yo, Marv, come on. He says, I got it. Don't worry about it. Next day, hello, Dave. This is Dale Parsons from WNBC. Would like you to come in for an interview. I was like, Marv, way to go. Yes. And that was, you know, that was, that's my Syracuse connection, if you will. So, you know, I've a lot of guys have been good to me over the years. And I hear from, and these days with social media and people, it's very flattering. A lot of kids, black and white, reach out. Hey, man, like what you do, like your style. Can you, give me some tips? Can you critique my tape? Don't hold anything back. And my wife even gives me a tip of the cap on that one, because there's probably about 20 guys and a bunch of them have landed now. And so it's nice to be in that position. But and then I'm involved with that black play-by-play scholarship fund too, that Adam Guardino started out of Connecticut. So there's been some really good young black guys coming along. They're gonna really be great. And some of them are great now. Everett Fitzhugh's already got a job at the Seattle Kraken, and was it Jason Ross is doing Chicago Blackhawks too? Two brothers doing hockey. I love that.
Yeah, Kevin Weeks. You know, we had him on our show.
That's the man right there. That dude is great.
He's really, really talented. He's so good.
Yeah, he's good.
Guys tend to think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort, but it's possible to have it both ways. I'm all set for summer thanks to Mack Weldon. The Vesper polo shirt is so breathable you can wear it on the golf course, but it looks classy enough to wear to a party. The Maverick Tech chino short is ultra flexible, and the Pima crew neck t-shirt is perfect for those casual weekends. There's no need to be uncomfortable in your clothing ever again. Some guys just want to look good without calling attention to themselves. Mack Weldon apparel gives you understated good looks for understated confidence. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes, but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. Crazy comfortable but elevated sweatpants. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads. An ultra-soft antimicrobial tee for when you need to stay fresh longer. That's the Silver Crew Neck T-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code MLBSHOW. That's MackWeldon.com. Promo code MLB show.
And so I always think about, like, we talk about, you know, Jackie and the current issues that confront society, like whether, you know, many years, 75 years later, so to speak. Have you found some evolution in calling the game or just covering the game with the fact that some of the social issues are being taken on by sport, and you know, whether the bubble in the NBA or Kaepernick or kneeling or whatever it may be. I mean, what has evolved for you in terms of how to share those stories with the public?
Well, I know one thing. During the summer of 20, during the summer of COVID and the murder of George Floyd, all of a sudden, a lot of people knew where I was, knew my phone number, and they wanted to hear from me. And, you know, the ball club asked me to do a whole bunch of Zoom calls, and matter of fact, in 19, the end of the 19 season, we had 10 African-American players, 10. They tried to take a picture of that. Dave Roberts said, hey man, outside of the Dodgers, the Mariners are my favorite team because y'all got all the brothers, you know? So we did a lot of forums about guys' experiences in the game, what kind of, racial sensitivities, anecdotes that have happened to them. That particular year, guys were speaking out, and our ball club encouraged the guys to speak out about social injustice and everything. And I don't have a problem. And this, I tell you what, every year during Jackie Robinson I'll talk about it. I mean, and it's amazing how you see so many white people are uncomfortable talking about race. And, you know, nobody's perfect. We all have our prejudices, but you want the good stuff to come out in you, and to portray that as you live your life day to day, minute to minute. But it's that's one of the things that amazed me. You know, behind the scenes, people dog you but boy, you ask them to get out front, talk about some of these issues, man, they get very squeamish. They ain't gonna do it. And then others who were like, if you will, they're cool. They get it. They will talk about, you know, I can think of like in baseball, Doug, and you can relate to this. In baseball right now, if you're a Black American, you better be a star, because there are very few, if any, Black utility guys. Like back in the 60s and 70s, and in the 80s, the Mark McLemores, the Tony Phillips, the guys who may not be superstars, but they were great cogs in your team and they could play multiple positions. Those guys don't exist anymore, or very few of them exist in baseball now. Any of the Black kids, the Black guys you see playing now are usually superstars are darn near elite. And that's something that concerns me. It concerns me. We don't see enough. I remember Mr. Robinson in that last public appearance he made in 72 at the World Series. I like to see him, Black managers. Well, we got Dusty and Dave right now. And the Black third base coaches, there's a few, not many, but it's more than it was when I was growing up. There were none when I was growing up, so I consider that progress, but it may not be as fast as I would like, but it is what it is. And again, there's not, and here's the other thing too. You talked about your family and baseball, for whatever reason, and I always feel like I'm in the last generation of Black Americans who really are wholeheartedly into baseball. And my kids were, two boys in their 30s, were very good athletes, good baseball players, and their connection to baseball is me. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't follow it. They sort of follow it, but they don't follow it like the NBA and the NFL. So, I mean, that's a problem too. And then one time I was looking around at our ballpark and I was counting as 1, 2, 3. Hey, there's Floyd Little, the now late great running back, Hall of Fame running back. And, you could count the Black folks. That's a whole different sort of story. Seattle's population of Black people is not, overwhelming by any stretch. But the point being, remember being here in Chicago a couple of years ago, Wrigley Field, I saw more Black people setting up than I saw in the stands, setting up, concessions and whatnot. So that's a little worrisome. And I would like for baseball to get back where it had. I mean, it may not ever catch the NFL, but I want it, to have a good hold on the community again. I would like to see that again, because it was, you could go around Philly, you grew up in Philly, and you could find Black kids playing baseball all over town. And it was great. And, slowly but surely, it's getting back there.
Yeah. Well, you think of, back HBO, and I did a follow-up on this a couple of years ago when Chris Rock talked about baseball in the Black community on HBO. And it was, a lot of, realism in it within, the comedy elements of it. I'm curious what you think about some of the efforts, whether the Selig rule in policy that Major League Baseball has tried to address this. And because, that when it comes down to it, Jackie Robinson was about equality. And although, yes, him being a Black American trying to get there was one effort, but he really wanted everyone to celebrate under the same umbrella. Like, I want what you have. I want to be as free as you are. Like, very simple. And I'm going to keep fighting and sort of staying on that accelerator. So I'm curious what you think about, what baseball has tried to do. I know they have this thing called MLB on Deck, where kind of diversity around it in terms of ticketing and forward facing elements of their organization. What have you seen, or what discussions have you had?
There are very few PR guys. Very few guys. Kevin Gregg did a great job in Boston. He's doing a great job in Philly. He might be the first director of media relations I've seen in baseball in my 16 years. And I'd like to see, there are more women. I'd like to see more, Black women involved. I know MLB Network has expanded, their diversity this year, adding more women and more people of color. I think that's been great. And I think a lot of stuff. And the other thing too, I'd like to see baseball bang the drum on that they're doing. And I'm sure somebody's going to tell me, yeah, we are doing it. Well, whatever you're doing, keep it going and maybe amp it up even more, And so people know what the story is, so they get a look at people who are involved in a day-to-day. And everybody's not going to be a baseball star. Not everybody's going to be Ken Griffey Jr. on the field. But, you can still be around a game that you love and participate in it. And also, the Hunter Greens of the world who come up. I mean, I watched him the other day. Goodness gracious, a right-hander with Cincinnati Reds, 6'4", 230. Saw him his last spring training against the Mariners. He looked good. And he's he's got a chance to be a terrific player, but let's know about more of those guys. Let's know more about even, and all the players, Trout, Ohtani, keep pumping whatever it is. I just think we need to pump it up. Whatever efforts, I know people are putting a lot of time into it, doing a good job, but, you know, keep it going and amp it up. I would love to see, you know, more people in front office, you know, media relations, sales. I think the Mariners have done a decent job. I think our numbers are pretty good. It can always be better all around baseball. I'm not just singling at my club, but, get out there and look for people. Oh, and here's another one I always think about. Summertime, black internships. I mean, go to HBCUs. I mean, forever. I can remember back when I was at the Daily News, and I can remember one time I came in, it was 1978, and Caroline Kennedy comes in as an intern. Mm-hmm. That's cool. Yeah. But, you know, what about some stellar black students from, you know, local schools? Give them a shot too. Mm-hmm. Nothing against Caroline Kennedy, a big fan of the family, yada, yada, yada. But I mean, come on. And it's, and internships, I know in other places I've been, it's been, you could almost define, you know, what they're looking for. And that's what I see every summer. I mean, it's the same cookie cutter stuff. I mean, hey, let's diversify a little bit. My goodness gracious. Give some kids. I'm not saying not everything's about, you know, being a handout and everything, but sometimes you got to go search for people. You know, if they're not coming to you, you go look for them. And I think that's something that needs to be done to encourage, hey, man, baseball's a cool game. It's a great, great way of life. It's a great business. Hey, I want to open your eyes to it, expose you to it. And if you like it, hey, stick around. Maybe we can do something.
Well, and sometimes that's the big challenge, because when you have homogeneity in the leadership and sort of just a natural human reaction of like hiring people that have your experiences and are in your circles. And I mean, Theo Epstein was very good about being introspective about that and saying, yeah, why do I hire, you know, people who have my experience? And when your experience is not diverse, then that's what happens. So, correct. So there's a deliberate nature to it. In my class, I always talk about power, and it's Eric Liu talks about how power concentrates, right? Power justifies itself. And so these ideas of like, once you have it, you kind of keep turning it over. And so when you think about the success of a sport, like anything, you say, I want everybody to love this sport. I'm not trying to discriminate in my fan base. I just want everybody to love it.
No way.
And representation does make a difference, because just as I talked about my family in Philadelphia, when the city took the time to apologize, when they brought me in as a player, it meant something to people who had been ostracized in the past. Yeah. And Jackie certainly was, you know, he was ahead of his time in a way in thinking of that, right? He went from baseball to all these executive positions saying, no, I got to replicate this work here too. Like, you know, they're all institutions in America, and the power resides whether in, you know, the banking where the money, the power to write, and be in the media and control the message.
Chock full of nuts.
Yeah, chock full of nuts and policy. I mean, you know, these are the arenas that he had targeted. So,
I always talk about, and I remember somebody used this word, and consequential. And I think that is one of the greatest definitions you could have for Mr. Robinson. I mean, he just changed everything. I mean, he opened the door for the Latin American players, the African Latino guys to play in Major League Baseball. We wouldn't have Roberto Clemente and a whole group of folks. So, yeah, man, I think every day when I go to the ballpark, and whether I wear my 42 cap or not, you know, I'm sort of like paying homage Mr. Robinson and my dad and that generation of black of Americans and that generation of black Americans specifically, because I can think of my grandfathers. I can hear one of them right now. Boy, you want to do what? I ain't never going to be able to do that. And boy, they ain't going to let you get in there and do that job. You're doing, I would love to see him right now. I say, yo, Pops, take a look at this. I'm calling Major League Baseball. What?
Yeah, I mean it's amazing. And what about the family though? Have you had a chance, like in 1991, right before I got drafted, I went to an event through an agent, and or at least an agent in the industry. It wasn't my agent ultimately, but And he introduced me to Rachel Robinson. And I remember, because I had read the books as, you know, as a kid, I remember just literally being almost breathless because I was like, this is the queen. So
that's exactly right. That was no question.
I mean, it was royalty. So I just took this picture and I'm digging it up now, trying to find it. But obviously it's somewhere in this box. But I mean, so meeting them, you know, to bring them to life in a way, that's been magical. What's your experience been like?
I tell you what, funny story. So I live in Manhattan, and I'm walking to work one day, and I get to it was 49th and 7th, and I'll never forget this. I was on the southeast corner, and I'm waiting across the street because I'm walking westbound, and I see this woman cat a corner from me. I said, "Damn, she looks familiar." I said, "Wait a minute, that's not family." I said, "Hey, dummy, that's Mrs. Robinson." Man, I practically ran out in the street. Oh, Mrs. Robinson, good to be killed. Oh, my God. Hey, here's what I do. I freaked out. I totally fanboyed it, man. I was like, I think back that now, I said, God, you were an idiot when you met her. But you couldn't help it. I mean, you said it was like meeting a queen. I was like, wait a minute, this is Mrs. Jackie Robinson, dude. And she was phenomenal. I startled her, but she regained her composure quickly. And then again, I met her at another thing at the Waldorf one time. And Mr. Dobie was there and everything. But I'll never forget that. You're right, though. You nailed it. It was like meeting royalty. I mean, this is a woman married to the guy. I mean, and they were a team. I mean, in all the readings, with the books, and we probably read the same books and same accounts and everything. I mean, that was a team. And thank the Lord that he was married to her and her strength of character to get him through. Cause there had to have been some brutal nights. They're throwing at him, spiking him, cussing him, spitting at him, a whole thing. And then you throw in an 0-for-4 here and there.
Yeah, right.
And right. I mean, it tells you how special this woman was, and God bless her. She's going to be 100 years old coming up in July. I mean, that she is special.
Are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever, and that's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. One more great product from LinkedIn. You're there to network, you're there to look for jobs, you're there to post jobs. And how about LinkedIn Sales Navigator? It's a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals such as job changes or which accounts you should prioritize, and shows you hidden allies so you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date, first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/baseballshow. That is linkedin.com/baseballshow for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/baseballshow and get started.
Well, you think about I always go back. I was a Hamilton musical fan. And you think about Eliza Hamilton portrayed and how she lived 40, 50 years after him, but did all this to preserve the legacy. And so he had a tag team. He had not only he had Rachel, but he had Sharon Robinson, who wrote a lot of books about family and what it was like growing up. I was fascinated interviewing Sharon Robinson, asking her about growing up. And she said, well, one thing that's interesting is our family integrated Stamford Public Schools in Connecticut.
I remember reading that.
Yeah, she was saying they gave me no cliff notes. They didn't tell me. They were just like, go ahead, figure it out.
That's a good
point. And she was like, what? Yeah. You were like the man, like what? They were like, so I mean, it's amazing. Like even they weren't always sure as a parent what to say to how to protect your kids from experiences.
Big life, man. Yep. Their experience. Wow. Yeah, that's. I recommend to everybody the book that jumps at Jules Tigel wrote that one book. What was it The Great Experiment? Mm-hmm. I thought that was one of the really good books that devoted to the Robinson and Ricky. I thought that was that impacted me pretty well. And there's been a whole bunch of others.
Yeah, well, Sharon's book Stealing Home was about really the household growing up.
Yeah,
and I thought was really powerful about that is. You realize, Robinson was 10 years younger than Martin Luther King Jr. So King, when he was a junior in college at Morehouse, that's when Robinson broke in. He was, and by the way, he was 18. He was a 15-year-old freshman and 18 years old.
Yeah, he was super smart.
So that was, you know, so a lot of the pioneers that came, you know, for the civil rights movement, they looked to Jackie as inspiration. Oh, and that was, and he had his jazz events in Connecticut and all these things to raise money for King. But even, you know, Little Rock Nine, I mean, the list is so long of people who would call him. And it was interesting to watch how more and more he was trying to kind of lay low. And then it was like, hey, Jackie, I need your advice on how to go through this. And he just kind of found himself everywhere. And pretty soon he was at Kurt Flood's court cases for you. Yeah. I mean, the man did, I can't imagine how much he did in such a short period of time.
Seriously. I mean, he only lived to be 53. And I wonder, boy, I think every year I think about this. Geez, I wonder what he would be thinking right now if he were. He would be brought back and say, here's what's happening. And he'd go, I don't think he'd be real pleased.
Yeah, what would he say? You know, well, the thing about Dusty, right? I remember we talked at one point about Dusty Baker taking on mentorship by you know, having meetings and finding, I mean, I don't know if you've spoken to him. I'm sure you have over the recent, but what's the latest?
I just remember, you know, you talk about mentorship, and I went down, I did a project, I did an interview with Dusty for one of my son's businesses, but who doesn't love Dusty Baker? And I love the story about how he said, you know, Hank Aaron told his mom, I'll take your boy out, right? You know, once, you know, Dusty was up here. But one of the coolest nights, you talked about mentorship, and one of the coolest nights I ever had in my life, but especially as a professional, I want to say with Dusty's last year when he was with the Reds, and the great Shooty Babbitt, who's a scout, good friend, you probably know Shooty, or you probably met him, he was with the A's. I said, he was in one of our games. He said, hey, man, fellas getting together. I said, what do you mean? He says, all the black guys in the Cactus League and all the Latino guys invited to Dusty's house. Dude, there was like 60 guys.
Wow.
Ken Griffey Sr., you know, Wayne Embry from the NBA, Eric Davis, Sean Dunstan. I mean, it was a who's who of your contemporaries, right? And basically, it was like a fellowship meeting. And we talked about, and Wayne Embry got up and gave a very emotional speech about, hey, you guys are like the front-facing foot soldiers for Black and Latin America. And keep on keeping on doing what you do. Show up early, leave late, work your tail off, and be an example. And that was a moment. Well, I tell you what, I raved about that. I remember when, and then when Dusty left, I was, when Ron Washington was still the manager of the Rangers at Cactus League. I said, yo, man, you got to pick up the mantle. You got to have this annual meeting. Never had another one since then. Nothing on Ron. I'm not blaming Ron, but I'm just saying that was how impactful that gathering was to share a lot of commonalities, things that we're talking about right now and more. I thought, and I would love to be able to, you know, everybody, we all have our own gigs and everything, and we're spread out all over the country, but boy, would I love to get together, have a get together and have a meeting like that again, and have a, you know, maybe an annual, semi-annual, whatever, to have a situation like, because we don't get a chance, you know, we see each other, hey, how are you, good to see you, give a hug and everything, hey, what's going on, boom, and that's it.
Yeah, well, I think maybe Players Alliance has tried to pick that up. And the thing about the Players Alliance that's fascinating is it formed mostly as a Zoom support group around George Floyd. Sure. And so players were talking, it's like, we need to get together. And then it quickly became, you know, kind of a partner with MLB to try to help them work on policy. It was a lot really quickly, but that seemed to be an opportunity to, you know, look at the community and figure out how they can connect those dots and bring people together around it.
Sure.
Yeah. So, but yeah, so, and you know, so I always think of, you know, where we're going, you know, sort of, Jackie Robinson laid tremendous groundwork as, and his family continued that and are continuing. And, you know, we see some change, you know, we look at the, there's a report every year by Tides to discuss diversity and equity, along all these sports. Baseball generally has done well outside of ownership and the power structure, in the real top, which in the end is still the policy setters. So where do you see the game going in this realm, in the spirit of Jackie?
Wow, that's a very good question. I wish I had a good answer for you. I just hope that, you know, we continue to bring more guys in as players. And as we mentioned earlier, the various and sundry positions that exist in the game. And and just, you know, just probably, and one thing we do as Americans, we know how to sell things. We know how to beat the drum. We know how to promote stuff. We need to get that mechanism going and talk and talk about and brag about and get chesty about what we're doing in you know, in the, those realms to get, to let people know, hey, we are, not only are we saying it, but we're doing it. And I think that would be huge. I really, and again, I salute the people who are doing that right now. And I encourage them to keep it going and to amp it up. Yeah. You know, make more noise of, more joyous noise to show that we've come a long, long way from April 1547, from 1947. We've come a long way and we're gonna take it to even higher levels.
Yeah, and I think so much of that falls in the next generation. You know, I love that, you know, my kids know his story and you feel like you have to kind of retell it in different ways, you know, through Twitter now or whatever. But, you know, I guess I close in asking you, like, what do you think it is about Jackie Robinson that sustains? Like, what?
It's funny you mention it because at this time of year, the time of year we're in right now, you know, high religious with Easter time. And it's like the story of Passover. You got to tell it every year, man. You got to, seriously. I mean, you got to just tell it every to my Jewish brethren, to my Jewish family and everything. You got to bang this. You got to talk about this story every year. And it's not restricted to just Black folks. It's for everybody in this country and around the world. And obviously, particularly in this country, to spread this word to get the new booster, if you will. Of knowledge and reinformation and retelling the story and growing and pushing forward. I can't sit here and tell you I got all the answers, but I mean, I think that would be certainly the path you want to take. And hopefully that's going to end you up in a good spot.
Well, Dave Sims, you know, I want to really thank you for your time today. I mean, it is a pleasure and always admired you initially from more afar professionally, but as we got to know each other more and it ran into you in Arizona in spring training, it's been a pleasure and I really appreciate your effort because you are charting, you know, your own way, but you're charting it for others as well. And so I appreciate your mentorship and sharing all this about Jackie Robinson and his inspiration in your life.
I appreciate that, Doug. Means a lot. And I can still hear Dan Baker. No batting. Such a fielder.
Number six.
Doug Benville.